These currents then ramify and branch out in the most delicate way to form a kind of net. This becomes a sort of membranous network at the boundary of the ether body. Before we began practicing, the ether body was not enclosed. The currents of life flowed in and out from the universal ocean of life directly and unhindered. Now, however, all influences from the outside have to pass through this thin web or skin. As a result, we become sensitive to outer currents and begin to perceive them. The time has now come to give this complex system of currents and movements a center near the heart. This is done by continuing the concentration and meditation exercises. At the same time, this moment marks the stage of our development at which we receive the gift of the inner word. Henceforth, all things have a new sense and meaning for us. They become, as it were, spiritually audible to us in their inmost essence. They speak to us of their true nature. What happens is that the currents described above put us in touch with the inner life of the cosmos to which we belong. We begin to participate in the life around us and let this life reverberate in the movements of our lotus flowers. With this, we enter the world of the spirit. We become able to understand the words of the great teachers of humanity in a new way. The Buddha's sermons, or the Gospels, for example, work upon us in a completely new way. They stream through us, permeating us with a bliss we never imagined before, for the melody of their words harmonizes with the movements and the rhythms that we have formed within ourselves. Now we can know directly that beings such as the Buddha or the writers of the Gospels do not voice their own revelations, but only what flows into them from the innermost essence of things. Here I may point out something that can be understood only in light of what we have learned about the ether body. Many educated people today find the repetitions in the Buddha's discourses difficult to understand. But once we embark upon the esoteric path, we learn to enjoy dwelling on these repetitions with our inner senses. For these repetitions correspond to certain rhythmical movements in the ether body, and when we surrender to the repetitions in perfect inner peace, our inner movements blend harmoniously with them. When we listen to the word melodies of the Buddha's teaching, our life becomes infused with the secrets of the universe. For the movements of Buddha's word melodies mirror cosmic rhythms that also consist of repetitions and regular returns to earlier rhythms. Spiritual science speaks of four faculties that must be acquired on the so-called preparatory path, or path of probation, before one can advance to higher knowledge. The first is the ability to distinguish in our thinking between truth and appearance, between what is true and what is simply opinion. The second is the ability to value truth and reality rightly in relation to appearances. The third consists in the application of the six qualities mentioned in the preceding chapter: control of thoughts, control of actions, perseverance, tolerance, faith, and equanimity. The fourth is the love of inner freedom. Mere intellectual understanding of what is contained in these faculties is quite useless. They must be integrated in the soul and establish inner habits there. Take, for example, the first faculty of distinguishing between truth and appearance. Here, we must train ourselves so that it becomes second nature to discriminate between what is not essential and what is meaningful in everything we encounter. Such training requires us to practice this discrimination with regard to everything we observe in the outer world. We must seek to do this at all times and with complete inner calm and patience. Eventually, our eyes will come to turn as easily to what is real and true as they turned before to what was not essential. And the truth of Goethe's words that everything transient is but a symbol will become a natural conviction in our souls. The same process also applies, of course, to the development of the other three faculties mentioned above. Under the influence of these faculties, now become inner soul habits, the delicate human ether body becomes transformed. The practice of the first, distinguishing between truth and appearance, forms the center for the lotus flower in the head, and at the same time prepares the center near the larynx. The actual formation of these centers, however, depends upon carrying out the concentration exercises mentioned above. The concentration exercises develop and form the centers, while the practice of the four inner habits of soul brings them to maturity. Once the center near the larynx is prepared, the second faculty, that of rightly valuing the true over inessential appearance, enables us to freely control, cover, and mark the boundaries of the ether body with the web or network. At this point, if we value the truth above all things and make this second nature, we gradually begin to see spiritual facts. But we should never make the mistake of thinking that a rational, intellectual evaluation of what is significant should determine our actions. Even the smallest acts and the least chores have a significance in the great household of the cosmos. It is a matter of becoming conscious of this significance, of not undervaluing the everyday affairs of life, and of learning to value them rightly. We have already discussed the six virtues: control of thought and actions, perseverance, patience, faith, and equanimity, that combine to form the third faculty. These virtues are connected with the development of the 12-petaled lotus flower near the heart. It is to this region, as we indicated above, that we must guide the ether body's current of life. The fourth faculty, that of desiring liberation, serves to bring the ether organ near the heart to maturity. Once this love of freedom has become a soul habit, we ourselves become free of all that is connected only with the capacities of an individual, personal nature. We cease to look at things from our own separate, particular point of view. The boundaries set by the narrow self, which chain us to this perspective, vanish, and the mysteries of the spiritual world may enter our inner life. This is the sought-for liberation. The fetters of the narrow self force us to view beings and things in a personal way. To attain higher knowledge, we must become free of these fetters of a personal and limited way of looking at things. One can see from all this that the instructions drawn from spiritual science work decisively into the innermost depths of human nature. The directions regarding the four faculties are instructions of this kind. They are to be found in one form or another in all the philosophies that acknowledge the existence of a spiritual world. The founders of such philosophies did not bequeath these instructions to humanity on the basis of some vague feeling. They did so because they were great initiates. They formed their moral precepts on the basis of their cognition. They knew that these precepts would affect humanity's finer and nobler nature, and they wanted their disciples gradually to train this nature. To live by such worldviews and philosophies means to work on perfecting ourselves spiritually. Only when we do this do we serve the cosmos as a whole. To perfect oneself in this way is by no means selfish. As long as we are imperfect human beings, we are also imperfect servants of humanity and the world. The more perfected we are, the better we can serve the whole. The saying, "If a rose is beautiful, it makes the garden beautiful," is also true of human beings. The founders of the greatest philosophies are therefore great initiates. Their teachings flow into human souls, and by this means the whole world advances with humanity. Indeed, they worked consciously for the progress of human evolution. Thus, we can understand the content of their teaching only when we bear in mind that it is drawn from knowledge of the inmost depths of human nature. The initiates were great Gnostics, seekers after knowledge. They knew, and they shaped humanity's ideals out of their knowledge. We too can approach these great leaders of humanity if, in our own development, we seek to raise ourselves to their heights. After the ether body begins to develop in the way described above, a whole new life opens up before us. To find our way in this new life, we need the enlightenment that esoteric training at the appropriate moment can provide. For example, at a certain point, the 16-petal lotus flower enables us to see spiritually the beings and forms of a higher world. But now we must learn to distinguish among the forms. They differ depending on whether they were caused by an object or a being. At first, we should pay attention to how our own thoughts and feelings can influence these forms, strongly or only slightly or perhaps not at all. Some forms will change immediately if, when we first see them, we think, "That is beautiful," and then in the course of contemplation change that to, "That is useful." These forms that characteristically change with our every thought or feeling are those produced by minerals or human-made objects. Forms arising from plants change less in response to our thoughts and feelings, and those of animals even less so. These latter forms are full of life and movement. This mobility is due partly to the influence of our thoughts and feelings, and partly to causes over which we have no control. In the world of forms, however, there are some that remain, initially at least, outside human influence. By inner study, we can determine to our satisfaction that such forms may be ascribed neither to minerals or artificial objects, nor to plants or animals. Further clarity is gained when we next observe the forms that we know result from people's emotions, instincts, passions, and so on. We find that our own thoughts and feelings still have an influence on these, although it is relatively slight. Thus, after eliminating all these, there still remains some forms upon which we have only a negligible effect, if any. Indeed, at the beginning of our esoteric practice, the forms upon which we can have hardly any influence at all constitute the greater part of what we can see. In fact, to understand the nature of this group, we must observe ourselves. Then we find out which forms we ourselves are causing. We discover that it is what we ourselves do, want, and so on that is expressed in these forms. They manifest our instincts, desires, and intentions. Indeed, our whole character is expressed by this particular world. In other words, we find that our conscious thoughts and feelings can influence all the forms in this higher world that are not produced by us. But once the forms produced by our being come into existence, we cannot influence them. To the eye of higher vision, a human being's inner life displays itself in outer figures, just like other things and beings. The inner world of instincts, desires, and ideas becomes, for higher cognition, a part of the outer world. Just as, when surrounded by mirrors in the physical world, we can see our bodily form from all sides, so in the higher world we can see a mirror image of our soul being. At this stage of esoteric development, we reach the point where we can overcome the illusion deriving from the narrowness of the personal self. Where before we regarded only what worked upon our senses as the outer world, now we can regard what lives inwardly in our personality also as an outer world. In this way, we gradually learn from experience to deal with ourselves in the same way as we deal with the beings in the world around us. If we were to see the spiritual worlds before we were sufficiently prepared for their nature, the picture of our own soul would arise before us as a riddle. For in this spiritual world we are faced with the figures and forms of our instincts and passions in animal, or more rarely, human shape. Though the forms of these animals in the spiritual world are never quite the same as they are in the physical world, there is nevertheless a similarity between them. The unpracticed observer would probably find them identical. Therefore, as we enter the higher world, we must acquire entirely new ways of evaluating what we see. Furthermore, not only do things that belong to our inner life appear outwardly around us, but they also appear as mirror images of what they really are. Numbers, for instance, must be read in reverse. 265 really means 562. Similarly, we see spheres as though we were at their center, and then we must translate, as it were, this interior view. Soul qualities, too, appear in mirror images. For example, a desire for something external will manifest as a form moving toward the desiring person. And the passions, which are seated in our lower nature, can take on the shapes of animals or animal-like beings hurling themselves upon us. In fact, of course, these passions are directed at the outside world. It is in the outer world that they seek the object that will satisfy them. In the mirror image, however, this seeking for satisfaction outside appears as an assault on the person harboring the passions. Esoteric students who, before ascending to higher vision, have come to know their own character traits by calm, objective self-observation, will find the strength and courage to act appropriately when they see the externalized mirror image of their inner being. But those who have not gained sufficient knowledge of themselves by such self-examination will not recognize themselves in their mirror image and will mistake that image for a different alien reality. Or the sight may frighten them, and because they cannot bear it, they may convince themselves that the whole thing is a fantastic figment without consequence. Clearly, as both cases demonstrate, reaching this stage of inner development prematurely and without proper preparation can fatally impede one's further training. In order to proceed further, it is essential to pass through the experience of spiritually seeing our own soul. For the soul and spirit beings we are best placed to understand are those which live within ourselves. If we have worked diligently in the physical world to acquire knowledge of our own personality, and we then immediately encounter its image in the higher world, we can compare the two. We can relate the higher phenomenon to one we already know, and thus set forth from solid ground. Otherwise, no matter how many other spiritual beings approach us, we would be unable to gain any understanding of their natures and special characters. Instead, we would soon feel the ground giving way beneath our feet. It cannot be emphasized often enough that the sure path to higher worlds leads through careful self-knowledge and the self-assessment of our own nature. What we first encounter on the road to the higher worlds are thus spiritual images. This is because the reality to which these images correspond lies within ourselves. Consequently, as students of the occult, we must be mature enough not to expect solid realities at this stage, and to consider images as appropriate to our present level of contemplation. But within this world of images, we can discover something new. Although our lower self comes before us only as a mirror image, our higher self appears in the middle of it, in its true reality. Out of the image of our lower personality, the true form of the spiritual I becomes visible. From this spiritual I, the threads are then spun out to other higher spiritual realities. This is the moment to use the two-petal lotus flower in the region of the eyes. Once this lotus flower begins to move, we are in the position to establish a connection between our higher I and higher spiritual beings. This is because the currents or streams emanating from this lotus flower move toward higher realities in such a way that we can be fully conscious of their movements. Indeed, just as light makes physical objects visible to our eyes, so these streams make the spiritual beings of the higher worlds visible to us. It is by means of meditative absorption in the ideas of spiritual science, which contain fundamental truths, that students of the inner path learn to set in motion and direct the currents that stream from the lotus flower between the eyes. At this point in our development, the value of sound judgment and a training in clarity and logical thought become especially evident. We need only bear in mind that the higher self, which until now has lain dormant within us, seed-like and unconscious, is here born into conscious existence. This birth is not just an image. It is a literal birth in an absolutely real sense, a birth into the spiritual world. And if it is to be viable, the being that is born, the higher self, must enter this world with all its necessary organs and faculties. Just as nature must take care that infants are born with fully formed healthy eyes and ears, so the laws of our own development must ensure that our higher self begins its conscious existence equipped with all the faculties it needs. The laws that are instrumental in the development of the higher spiritual organs are none other than the sound laws of reason and morality in the physical world. Just as babies mature in their mother's wombs, so the spiritual human being develops within the physical self. And just as the health of the baby depends on the normal functioning of the natural laws in the mother's womb, so the health of our spiritual humanity is likewise contingent on the laws of our ordinary understanding at work in our life on earth. No one can give birth to a healthy higher self who does not live and think in a healthy manner in the physical world. Living in harmony with nature and reason is the basis of all true spiritual development. Just as a baby, while still in its mother's womb, already lives according to the forces of nature that its sense organs will perceive only after it has been born, so in physical life, the human higher self already lives according to the laws of the spiritual world. And just as an unborn child, out of an obscure feeling or consciousness of life, makes use of the forces it needs, so we too can use the forces of the spiritual world before our higher self is born. Indeed, we must make use of these forces if our higher self is to enter the world as a fully developed being. It would be wrong, therefore, to think that we cannot accept the teachings of spiritual science until we can see for ourselves. For without immersing ourselves in such spiritual research, we cannot attain any higher knowledge at all. To refuse to do so would be like a baby's refusing to use the forces available to it through its mother's body and wanting to wait until it could acquire them for itself. Just as the embryo dimly feels the rightness of what it is offered, so we can have a sense for the truth of the teachings of spiritual science even before we become clairvoyant. Relying upon the feeling for truth and clear, healthy, many-sided critical thinking, we can gain an insight into the teachings of spiritual science, even though we do not yet see spiritual realities. First, we must study the fruits of mystical knowledge. This prepares us for our own spiritual perception. If we became able to see spiritually without such preparation, we would be like a child born with eyes and ears, but without a brain. The whole world of colors and sounds would be spread out before us, but we could form no connection with it. What was convincing and obvious to us before, because of our feeling for truth, our intuition, and our reason, becomes first-hand experience for us at the level of spiritual schooling or discipleship just described. We now have immediate knowledge of our higher self. And thereby we learn to recognize that this higher self is linked with spiritual beings of a still higher order and forms a unity with them. Moreover, we see that our lower self also originates in the higher world, and we are shown that our higher nature outlasts our lower nature. Consequently, we ourselves can now distinguish our transitory part from our permanent self. In other words, we come to understand by our own power of vision the doctrine of the embodiment, or incarnation, of the higher self in the lower self. It then becomes clear that we are part of a higher spiritual context which determines our qualities and our destiny. We begin to understand the law of human life, namely karma. We realize that our lower self, which shapes our existence in the present, is only one of the many forms our higher being can assume. And in this way, we realize that it is possible to work on the lower self from the perspective of the higher self in order to become more and more perfect. From this moment on, we become able to discern great differences between human beings with respect to their degree of perfection. We become aware that there are people more advanced than we are who have reached levels that still lie ahead of us. It becomes clear, too, that their teachings and actions derive from inspiration from the higher worlds. We recognize that this is so from our own first glimpses of those worlds. Thus, the expression, "great initiates of humanity," now begins to take on concrete meaning for us. The gifts that the student of the inner path receives by virtue of achieving this stage of development are these: insight into the higher self and into the doctrine of the embodiment or incarnation of this higher self in a lower self, Insight into the law by which life in the physical world is regulated according to spiritual relationships, the law of karma. And finally, insight into the existence of the great initiates. Therefore, it is said of students who have reached this stage that they lose all doubt. Before, their faith was built on reason and healthy thinking. But now, this faith can be replaced by complete knowledge and insight that nothing can shatter. Religious ceremonies, sacraments, and rites give us outwardly visible images of higher spiritual processes. Only a person who has not yet fully understood the depths of the great religions can fail to see that this is so. Once we can look into spiritual reality, we can also understand the great significance of those outwardly visible actions. Then religious services themselves become an image of our relationship to the higher spiritual world. By reaching this stage of inner development, students of the spirit actually become new beings. They can now mature gradually to the point where, by means of the currents of the ether body, they are able to control a still higher element, the element of life, and thereby achieve a great degree of freedom from the physical body. Chapter 7, Changes in the Dream Life of the Esoteric Student. An indication that we have reached, or soon will reach, the stage of development described in the last chapter is the change that occurs in our dream life. Previously, our dreams were muddled and random. Now, they begin to take on a more orderly character. Their images connect in a meaningful way, like the thoughts and ideas of waking consciousness. We begin to recognize lawfulness and cause and effect in them. At the same time, the content of our dreams also changes. Whereas our dreams formerly contained only echoes of our daily lives and transformed impressions of our surroundings or our own bodily condition, the images we now see arise out of a world unknown to us before. At first, however, the general character of the dreams remains the same. That is, compared to waking consciousness, our dreams continue to express their content symbolically. Any careful study of dreams confirms this undeniably symbolic character. For example, we may dream that we have caught a horrible creature that feels unpleasant in our hands. Awakening, we find that we have been clutching a corner of the blanket. The dream expresses this experience not directly and unvarnished, but in a symbol. Or we may dream that we are fleeing a pursuer and feel afraid. Waking up, we discover we suffered palpitations of the heart while we were asleep. Again, if our stomach is filled with heavy, difficult-to-digest food when we fall asleep, this too can produce anxious dreams. Events occurring in our surroundings while we are asleep may similarly be reflected symbolically in dreams. The striking of a clock can evoke images of soldiers marching by to the beat of drums. Or the crash of a chair falling can stimulate a whole drama in which the noise is symbolically reflected in the dream as a gunshot. The more orderly and structured dreams that we begin to experience once our ether bodies have begun to develop retain this symbolic mode of expression, but they no longer reflect only events that are connected to our physical surroundings or bodily processes. For, as the dreams originating in physical reality become increasingly regulated, they begin to mix with images expressing conditions and events of another world. At this point, then, we begin to have experiences inaccessible to ordinary waking consciousness. But we should never for a moment believe that true mystics, if they experience something of this order in a dream, take such dream experiences as the basis for an authoritative account of the higher worlds. Such dream experiences should be viewed only as the first signs of higher development. A further consequence of this development is that it soon becomes apparent that dream images no longer lie outside the guidance of our rational mind, but may be considered by this intelligence in as orderly and lawful a way as the ideas and sensations of waking consciousness. In this way, the difference between the waking state and the dream consciousness increasingly disappears. We begin to remain awake, in the full sense of the word, during our dream life. That is, we begin to feel ourselves lords and masters of our pictorial representations. When dreaming, we are actually in a different world from the one revealed to us by the physical senses. However, as long as our spiritual organs are undeveloped, we can form only a muddled idea of this world. Until then, it exists for us only as much as the sensible world would exist for a being with only the most primitive, rudimentary eyes. This is why we usually see only images and reflections of daily life in this second world. We see these images and reflections because our soul paints the pictures of its daytime perceptions into the stuff of which the dream world is made. In other words, we must realize that, in addition to our ordinary conscious daytime life, we also lead a second unconscious life in this other dream world. We engrave or imprint everything we perceive or think onto this other world, but we can see these imprints only if our lotus flowers have been developed. These lotus flowers, of course, are always present in us, but only in a skeletal, undeveloped form. We cannot perceive anything with them in our waking state because the impressions made upon them in that state are very weak. The reason for this is similar to why we do not see the stars by day. Namely, their light is too weak when compared with the powerful light of the sun. In the same way, the weaker impressions of the spiritual world count for very little when compared to the powerful impressions of the physical senses. When the doors of the outer senses are closed during sleep, these impressions from the spiritual world light up at random. As they do so, we then become, as dreamers, aware of experiences in the other world. At first, of course, these experiences consist of no more than what the sense-bound mind imprints on the spiritual world. Only the development of the lotus flowers makes it possible to inscribe manifestations that do not belong to the physical world. Thereafter, complete knowledge of such inscriptions deriving from other worlds becomes possible with the development of the ether body. This marks the beginning of our contact and communication with a new world. We must now accomplish, by means of the instruction provided by esoteric training, a twofold task. First, we must become as conscious of what we observe in our dreams as we are of what we observe in waking life. Second, once we can do this, we must be able to carry this consciousness of dream observation into our ordinary waking state. In other words, our attention for spiritual impressions must be so developed that these impressions no longer vanish in the presence of physical impressions. Rather, we must be able to have both types of perceptions at the same time, side by side. Once we have developed this faculty, certain elements of the picture described in the previous chapter appear before our spiritual eyes. From this point on, we can see that what exists in the spiritual world is the cause of what exists in the physical world. But within this spiritual world, we must first come to know our higher self. Next, we must grow into this higher self. That is, we must consider it a real being and behave accordingly. This means that we immerse ourselves more and more in the idea and living feeling that our physical body and what we used to call ourself are really only instruments of the higher I. In this way, we begin to develop a relationship to our lower self that is like the relationship those who live only in the sense world feel toward their tools and vehicles. Just as we do not think of the car we drive as part of our I, even though we may say, I drive or I travel, so the words, I go in through the door, now come to mean, for those who have developed themselves, I take my body in through the door. This idea must become so natural and obvious to us that we never for a moment lose our solid footing in physical reality. We must never allow any feeling of estrangement or alienation from the sense world to arise. To avoid becoming fantasists and fanatics, We must take care that our existence of higher consciousness does not impoverish our life in the physical world, but enriches it. We must take great care that our experience in higher consciousness does not impoverish our life in the physical world, but enriches it. Once we have begun to live in the higher I, or rather, even as we are in the process of acquiring such higher consciousness, we learn not only how to awaken the spiritual forces of perception in the organ formed in the region of the heart, but also how to control it, using the currents described in earlier chapters. This perceptive force consists of an element of higher materiality streaming out from this organ near the heart and flowing in shining beauty through the rotating lotus flowers and the other channels of the developed ether body. Thence, it flows outward into the spiritual world around us, making this world spiritually visible to us, just as the sunlight outside, falling upon objects from without, makes them visible to our physical eyes. How this heart organ's force of perception is produced can be understood only gradually during the process of inner training itself. Not until we are able to direct this organ of perception through the ether body and into the outer world, so as to shine a light on the objects in it, can we see clearly the objects and beings of the spiritual world. It follows from this that perfect consciousness of an object in the spiritual world can arise only if we ourselves shed spiritual light upon it. In reality, the I that produces this organ of perception does not dwell within the physical body, but outside it, as we have previously indicated. The heart organ is only the place where we kindle the spiritual light organ from the outside. Were we to kindle this light organ somewhere else, the spiritual perceptions produced would have no connection to the physical world. As human beings, however, our task is to bring higher spiritual realities into relationship with the physical world. Humanity, indeed, is the means by which the spirit penetrates the physical realm, and the heart organ is precisely what the higher I uses to make the sensory self its instrument so that it can use it. When we have undergone the course of esoteric training described so far, the feeling that we experience for the things of the spiritual world becomes different from the feeling that ordinary, sense-bound human beings have for the physical world. The latter still feel themselves located in a particular place in the sense world, and the objects they perceive are viewed as being outside. As spiritually developed persons, however, we now feel ourselves as if united with the spiritual objects we perceive, as if we were inside them. In other words, we wander from place to place in spiritual space. For this reason, spiritual science calls those at this level of inner development wanderers, for they are not yet at home anywhere. Were we to remain mere wanderers, however, we would find it impossible ever to truly define any object in spiritual space. Indeed, just as we define objects and places in physical space by starting from a given point of reference, so likewise, if we wish to define things in spiritual space, we must establish a similar reference point from which to begin. We must find a place in this other world, explore it thoroughly, and spiritually take possession of it. We must establish our spiritual homeland in this place, and then set everything else in relation to it. This is just what we do in the physical world. There, too, we view things from the perspective of the ideas and beliefs of our native country. A Berliner, for example, will describe London in a different way than a New Yorker will. Yet there is a great difference between our physical and our spiritual homeland. We have nothing to do with our place of physical birth, where we grow up and instinctively absorb various ideas and beliefs, which then involuntarily color everything we experience. Our spiritual home is different. We create a spiritual home for ourselves in full consciousness. Therefore, any judgment emanating from it is made in perfect, lucid freedom. In the language of spiritual science, this making of a spiritual home is called building a hut. At this stage of development, spiritual perception is initially limited to the spiritual counterparts of the physical world, insofar as these are present in the so-called astral world. This world contains all that is of a similar nature to human instincts, feelings, desires, and passions. In fact, every sense object in our physical environment has some spiritual force related to such human soul characteristics associated with it. A crystal, for example, flows into its form by means of forces that, to clairvoyant higher vision, look like the instincts at work in human beings. Similarly, forces likewise draw the sap through the vessels of a plant, unfold its blossoms, and burst open its seed pods. Just as objects of the physical world have form and color for our physical eyes, so too these supersensible forces can take on shape and color for those who have developed spiritual organs of perception. For example, if we have reached this stage, we can now see not only physically visible crystals and plants, but also the spiritual forces associated with them. Just as we see tables and chairs in the physical world, we can now see human and animal instincts, not simply manifested outwardly in behavior, but directly as actual realities. Indeed, the entire world of instincts, drives, desires, and passions is now seen to form an astral cloud or aura enclosing every human being and animal. In addition, as seers, we can now also perceive things that almost or completely elude our sensory grasp. For example, we can notice the astral difference between a room filled largely with people oriented toward lower things and another containing those with higher aspirations. Not only is the physical atmosphere of a hospital different from that of a dance hall, the spiritual atmosphere is different as well. Similarly, a city that is a center of commerce does not have the same astral air as a university town. At first, of course, our capacity to perceive such things clairvoyantly is only weakly developed, just as our dream consciousness was weak in comparison with our waking consciousness before we began our inner work. Gradually, however, we mature and become fully awake on this level as well. The highest attainment of a clairvoyant seer who has reached this stage of vision comes when the astral counter-effect to human and animal instincts and passions is revealed. An action filled with love is accompanied by different astral phenomena than one arising out of hate. Meaningless desire produces an ugly astral counterpart or image, while the feeling for a high ideal creates a beautiful one. These astral counterparts are only faintly visible in physical life. Living in the physical world diminishes their strength. For example, desire for something produces a counterpart in the astral world in addition to the immediate astral image of the desire itself. If the desire is satisfied and its object attained, or if there is at least the possibility of satisfying it, then, for the time being, the astral counterpart of the desire will be weak. It will achieve its full strength only after the death of the individual. At that point, the soul, in accordance with its nature, will still harbor the same desire, but will now be unable to satisfy it because it lacks both the object and the organs necessary to enjoy it. If we are sensuously disposed in life, for instance, after our death, we may still crave the pleasures of the palate. But we can no longer satisfy this craving. We no longer have a palate. The consequence is that our desire now produces a particularly powerful astral counterpart, which torments our soul. Such experiences, occurring after death in relation to these counterparts of our lower soul nature, are called experiences in the soul realm, or more particularly, the region of desire. They disappear only after the soul has purified itself of all desire for the things of the physical world. Only then does the soul ascend to the higher realm, the spiritual world. Although these counterparts are only weak during our physical life, they nevertheless exist. They form our world of desires, accompanying us through life as a comet's tail accompanies its core. Thus, they may be perceived clairvoyantly by seers who have reached a certain stage of development. These and related experiences constitute the inner life of a student who has attained the stage of development described in this chapter. To attain still higher spiritual experiences, We must ascend from this stage and climb yet further on the path.